This is a production of Cornell University.
Thank you all for coming out on this very rainy Ithaca day for the latest installment in our Writers at Cornell reading series. Before we get started, I must ask you all to turn off your cell phones. By which I do not mean set your cell phones to vibrate, I mean turn them off. Lydia's in the house, after all. I'd like to thank the two anonymous donors, both of them Cornell alums, who've made this series possible. Thanks also to my colleagues in English and creative writing, especially our creative writing director, the great Elena Maria Viramontes. Thanks also to Karen Kuje and Marianne Marsh for their organizational acumen, and to John Niederbruhl for providing us with books, and Natty Dreads. And finally, we're all grateful to our graduate and undergraduate students for whose amusement and edification these events have been and will continue to be staged. Your enthusiasm and appreciation for our visitors has been exemplary, and I'm delighted to see you all here this afternoon. When the reading is over, please join us upstairs in the lounge, as usual, for a reception where, with any luck, we will feast upon the thingies with the almond shoved into the date wrapped in bacon, fingers crossed. And if you'd like to hear my interview with Lydia Davis, it is now available on the Writers at Cornell podcast blog. And you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You just search for Writers at Cornell in the search box. So it is my deep pleasure to get to introduce to you one of my very favorite writers, and I hope you'll indulge me in a slightly long-winded introduction. I've been a fan of Lydia Davis for a good decade and a half, but my first personal contact with her dates from just a couple of years ago, and I actually think this experience is a fine example, a fine introduction to the kind of writer she is. I was fortunate enough to have a book coming out, a story collection, and my editor asked me whom I would like him to ask for a blurb for the jacket. And when an editor asks a writer this question, what he means is, do you have any famous friends who will help us move some units? But what the writer always hears is, whose flattery would mean the most to you? So I asked him to please send the book to Lydia Davis. And to my surprise and pleasure, Lydia was indeed kind enough to supply a blurb for the book. But to our surprise, she also sent along something else, a two-page single-spaced list of very careful grammar corrections, listed by page number. And needless to say, they were all correct, and we incorporated them all into the manuscript. I don't think I need to explain how unusual this is. One of the most accomplished fiction writers at work today asked to read a book by someone she didn't know, performing an unsolicited copy edit on it. Of course, I interpreted this, quite correctly, as an act of generosity toward a fellow writer, and it is one for which I remain grateful, but it was also an expression, I think, of a particular creative philosophy, one that embraces precision and clarity above all, and a deep, abiding respect for other writers' words. The latter comes into play most notably in Davis's translation work. She's a highly accomplished translator of French literature. Indeed, she has just published a new translation of Madame Bovary, and is the most recent translator of Proust's Swan's Way, the first of the great seven volumes In Search of Lost Time. Her Swan's Way is, in a word, extraordinary. If you got to know this book from the familiar Sidney Moncrief translation, Davis's will be a revelation to you. It's a work of incredible clarity, a window into Proust's mind. In it, Davis has accomplished the translator's greatest trick, the hard-won illusion of having stepped aside to let the author speak. But the fiction. If you made a pile of Davis's collected translations and put it next to a pile of her collected fiction, which I should add consists of a series of superb books and chapbooks, including Break It Down, Almost No Memory, Samuel Johnson is Indignant, and Varieties of Disturbance, all now collected in her recent Collected Stories, just out of paperback, plus a novel, The End of the Story, you would be tempted to regard her as primarily a translator. But if the translator's job is to negate herself, to give us the clearest possible view of her subject, the fiction writer's job is the exact opposite, to imprint her personality onto the page, to distill the essence of her way of thinking, of being, into words. Davis's translations are great for what isn't there. Davis's fiction is great for what is. Which is not to say that absence itself is not often a subject of her fiction. The story Jury Duty tells in question and answer fashion, the story of a woman's failure to be chosen to serve on a jury. In Her Damage, a woman takes a series of photographs without first putting film in the camera. Another story, A Double Negative, reads in its entirety, at a certain point in her life, she realizes it is not so much that she wants to have a child as that she does not want not to have a child, or not to have had a child. Davis is masterful as well on the convolutions of friendship, marriage, and family, as in the very funny Thyroid Diary, the musings of a woman whose underactive thyroid is confusing her thoughts. And this is in this story, the narrator's husband has a student in his painting class who is also the wife of the narrator's dentist. And here's a quote from the story. "I've always been puzzled, anyway, by the economics of the thing, because I would pay the dentist, and he would presumably give his wife the money for her courses at the college. She would pay the college would pay my husband a separate fee for her tutorials, and then my husband would give me money for the dentist, I would pay the dentist would give money to his wife, and so it would continue. I thought that if no one paid anyone, it would work out just the same, but that didn't seem quite right either." Davis's narrator is often a polite, restrained, self-effacing woman seething with complicated ideas, a person of enormous wit that is rarely displayed in dialogue, of dark thoughts the other characters are never privy to. Her restraint itself is a wonderful joke that nobody else in the story seems to be getting. And she's a champion of the self-negating banality, like this one from Our Trip, a description of a tedious car journey in the company of husband and son. Quote, "At that point, I started trying to identify the new trees I had learned on our vacation. And when I gave up on that, I just watched the fat on my arm ripple in the wind from the open window." I suppose this is more about me than about Lydia, that is one of my favorite lines in all of contemporary fiction. In any event, Davis loves to write about small things, ephemeral things, things that are little more than ideas or errors in thinking or words or the sounds of words. Indeed, her great achievement is to show that the small is not small, that whole worlds are contained in the slightest of things. And the same can be said about the small pile of paper that is her life's work so far in fiction writing. This work is of such brilliant economy, intensity, and clarity that it says more in a few hundred pages than most writers could say in a few hundred years. What else can I say about her? She teaches writing at SUNY Albany. She's a MacArthur Fellow. She's won her Whiting and been nominated for the National Book Award and the Penn Hemingway Award. But what really matters about her is what you'll be hearing over the next hour. She's a great writer and a great citizen of literature. So please put together your nicotine-stained, nail-bitten creative writing hands for Lydia Davis.
Well, thank you. That was fun to listen to. I wish I didn't have to read right after. So I'm sopping wet, so if I start steaming, that's why. Can you hear me all right then with this, like this? Okay. I'm gonna read mostly new work today, but I'll start with two pieces from the collected stories, both, as it happens, sort of about death, but one a little heavier and the next one a little lighter. The first is called Grammar Questions. Now, during the time he is dying, can I say, this is where he lives? If someone asks me, where does he live? Should I answer, well, right now he is not living, he is dying. If someone asks me, where does he live? Can I say, he lives in Vernon Hall? Or should I say, he is dying in Vernon Hall? When he is dead, I will be able to say in the past tense, he lived in Vernon Hall. I will also be able to say, he died in Vernon Hall. When he is dead, everything to do with him will be in the past tense. Or rather, the sentence, he is dead, will be in the present tense. And also questions such as, where are they taking him, or where is he now? But then I won't know if the words he and him are correct in the present tense. Is he, once he is dead, still he? And if so, for how long is he still he? People may say the body and then call it it. I will not be able to say the body in relation to him because to me he is still not something you would call body. People may say his body, but that does not seem right either. It is not his body because he does not own it, even if he is no longer active or capable of owning anything. I don't know if there is a he, even though people will say he is dead, but it does seem correct to say he is dead. This may be the last time he will still be he in the present tense, or it will not be the last time, because I will also say he is lying in his coffin. I will not say, and no one will say, it is lying in the coffin, or it is lying in its coffin. I will continue to say my father in relation to him after he dies, but will I say it only in the past tense or also in the present tense? He will be put in a box, not a coffin. Then when he is in that box, will I say, that is my father in that box, or that was my father in that box, or will I say that in the box was my father? I will still say my father, but maybe I will say it only as long as he looks like my father or approximately like my father. Then, when he is in the form of ashes, will I point to the ashes and say, that is my father? Or will I say, that was my father? Or those ashes were my father? Or those ashes are what was my father? When I later visit the graveyard, will I point and say, my father is buried there? Or will I say, my father's ashes are buried there? But the ashes will not belong to my father. He will not own them. They will be the ashes that were my father. In the phrase, he is dying, the words he is with the present participle suggest that he is actively doing something. But he is not actively dying. The only thing he is actively doing is breathing. He looks as if he is breathing on purpose because he is working hard at it and frowning slightly. He is working at it, but surely he has no choice. Sometimes his frown deepens for just an instant as though something is hurting him or as though he is concentrating harder. Even though I can guess that he is frowning because of some pain inside him or some other change, he still looks as though he is puzzled or dislikes or disapproves of something. I've seen this expression on his face often in my life, though never before combined with these half-open eyes and this open mouth. He is dying sounds more active than he will be dead soon. That is probably because the word be. We can be something whether we choose to or not. Whether he likes it or not, he will be dead soon. He is not eating. He is not eating sounds active too, but it is not his choice. He is not conscious that he is not eating. He is not conscious at all. But is not eating sounds more correct for him than is dying because of the negative. Is not seems correct for him at the moment anyway, because he looks as though he is refusing something because he is frowning. Like some other pieces, that one just starts with one idea. Maybe the first idea in the thing, and then you continue to think about it and think about all the rest that sort of come from that, and then you sort of just end in the middle because it could go on forever. And this is called Letter to a Funeral Parlor. Dear Sir, I am writing to you to object to the word cremains, which was used by your representative when he met with my mother and me 2 days after my father's death. We had no objection to your representative personally, who was respectful and friendly and dealt with us in a sensitive way. He did not try to sell us an expensive urn, for instance. What startled and disturbed us was the word cremains. You in the business must have invented this word, and you are used to it. We, the public, do not hear it very often. We don't lose a close friend or a family member very many times in our life, and years pass in between if we are lucky. Even less often do we have to discuss what is to be done with a family member or close friend after their death. We noticed that before the death of my father, you and your representative used the words loved one to refer to him. That was comfortable for us, even if the ways in which we loved him were complicated. Then we were sitting there in our chairs in the living room trying not to weep in front of your representative who was opposite us on the sofa. And we were very tired, first from sitting up with my father and then from worrying about whether he was comfortable as he was dying and then from worrying about where he might be now that he was dead. and your representative referred to him as the Cremains. At first, we did not even know what he meant. Then, when we realized, we were frankly upset. Cremains sounds like something invented as a milk substitute in a coffee, like Cremora or Coffee Mate. Or it sounds like some kind of a chipped beef dish. As one who works with words for a living, I must say that any invented word like porta potty or pooper scooper has a cheerful or even jovial ring to it that I don't think you really intended when you invented the word cremains. In fact, my father himself, who was a professor of English and is now being called the cremains, would have pointed out to you the alliteration in porta potty and the rhyme in pooper scooper. Then he would have told you that cremains falls into the same category as brunch and is known as a portmanteau word. There is nothing wrong with inventing words, especially in a business, but a grieving family is not prepared for this one. We are not even used to our loved one being gone. You could very well continue to employ the term ashes. We are used to it from the Bible and are even comforted by it. We would not misunderstand. We would know that these ashes are not like the ashes in a fireplace. Yours sincerely. That began as an actual letter, and then it quickly got too literary to send. But after a time, I did, take it down to an ordinary letter style and send it, but I never did get an answer. So. It also gave birth to many other letters of complaint when I realized how many things I had to complain about. This next group of little pieces are dreams in one way or another. I never used to be very interested in dreams or writing down dreams or finding out what my dreams meant. I'm still not sure I'm very interested, but I had an experience in waking life that was so much like a dream that it reminded me of something a writer named Michel Leiris did, which was write down all his dreams, but also all his waking experiences that were like dreams, and he put them in one volume after 40 years. And I liked the idea of mixing so that you never quite know what's a dream and what's not. And it also makes you think differently about your experiences when you can see them as possible dreams, dream narratives. So I wrote these for a while, and I would take not only my own experiences, but also friends' experiences. So that was a bit new. Friends would tell me dreams or waking experiences. So I'm going to read a few of those. The Husband Seekers. Flocks of women land on an island seeking husbands from a tribe of very beautiful young men. They blow across the sea like cotton buds or seeds of wild plants, and when rejected, they pile up offshore in a floating bank of woolly white. Two Sligo lads are on their way to work at an immense factory that looms up ahead of them on the horizon. Abruptly, then, they are whirled up into a fairground ride consisting of spinning cars moving in elliptical arcs so far above me that they are mere specks in the sky. As they revolve, crossing over and over, they cry out to me, "Hello, hello," again and again at irregular intervals. Then the ride is gone, but they are still there, circling. They might now be seagulls. Awake in the night. I can't go to sleep in this hotel room in this strange city. It is very late, 2 in the morning, then 3, then 4. I am lying in the dark. What is the problem? Oh, maybe I am missing him, the person I sleep next to. Then I hear a door shut somewhere nearby. Another guest has come in very late. Now I have the answer. I will go to this person's room and get in bed next to him. Then I will be able to sleep. Dinner. I am still in bed when friends of ours arrive at the house for dinner. My bed is in the kitchen. I get up to see what I can make for them. I find 3 or 4 packages of hamburger in the refrigerator, some partly used and some untouched. I think I can put all of the hamburger together and make a meatloaf. This would take an hour, but nothing else occurs to me. I go back to bed for a while to think about it. The piano. We are about to buy a new piano. Our old upright has a crack all the way through its sounding board and other problems. We would like the piano shop to take it and resell it, but they tell us it is too badly damaged and cannot be resold to anyone else. They say it will have to be pushed over a cliff. This is how they will do it. 2 truck drivers take it to a remote spot with a high elevation. One turns his back and walks away down the lane, while the other shoves it over the cliff. The piano lesson. I am with my friend Christine. I have not seen her for a long time, perhaps 17 years. We talk about music and we agree that when we meet again, she will give me a piano lesson. In preparation for the lesson, she says, I must select and then study 1 Baroque piece, 1 classical, 1 romantic, and 1 modern. I am impressed by her seriousness and by the difficulty of the assignment. I am ready to do it. We will have the lesson in 1 year, she says. She will come to my house. But then later she says she is not sure she will be returning to this country. Maybe instead we will have the lesson in Italy. Or if not Italy, then of course Casablanca. At the bank, 1. I take my bag of pennies to the bank and throw them into a machine that will count them. I am asked by a functionary to guess how much my pennies are worth. I guess $3. I am wrong. They amount to $4.24. But since I am within $1.99 of the correct sum, I qualify for a prize. Many people nearby in the bank congratulate me warmly. I may choose from among a number of prizes. When I refuse the first and the second, and seem likely to refuse the next, the anxious teller unlocks a secure vault and shows me the full array, which includes a large plastic piggy bank, a coloring book and crayons, and a small rubber ball. At last, so as not to disappoint her, I choose what I think is the best of them, a handsome frisbee with its own carrying case. At the bank, 2. Again, I go to the bank with a bag full of pennies. Again, I guess that my pennies will add up to $3. The machine counts them. I have $4.92. Again, the bank officer says I'm close enough to the correct amount to win a prize. I look forward to seeing what the selection of prizes will be this time. But there is only 1 prize, a tape measure. I am disappointed, but I accept it. At least this time I can tell that the bank officer is a woman. Each time before, there was no way to tell if she was a woman or a man. But this time, though she is still bald, her motions are less mechanical, her voice is higher, she smiles, and there's a pin on her chest that says, Janet. The grandmother. A man has come to my house carrying a very large peach tart. He has also brought with him some other people, including a very old woman who complains about the gravel and is then carried into the house with great difficulty. At the table, the old woman observes to one man by way of conversation that she likes his teeth. Another man keeps shouting in her face, but she is not frightened. She only looks at him balefully. Later, when she is back at home, it is discovered that while she has been eating many cashews from a bowl, she has also eaten her hearing aid. even though she chewed on it for nearly 2 hours, she could not reduce it to particles small enough to swallow. At bedtime, she spat it out into the hand of her caregiver and told him this nut was a bad one. Next, I'd like to read 10 stories from Flaubert. And the way these stories came about was I was working on Madame Bovary, and while I worked on it, I was reading his letters from the time he was writing it, so from the mid-50s, to Louise Collet, his lover and a poet. And every now and then he would tell a little story to her of something that had just happened to him. And enough of them were self-contained stories so that I felt these are sort of lost in these letters. I would like to bring them out and shape them a bit and make something of them, so a little bit more, shape them a bit more. And it made reading the letters more exciting because it was something of homework that I was doing for something that was at times like a job. So every now and then I discover this little buried treasure. And so I translated them, but I also, the reason I can sort of claim them to some extent is that I did do a lot of fiddling with them in a way that I wouldn't with a translation. I would cut sentences or parts of sentences. If he said Madame, sometimes I would take it out because I didn't want the stories to seem too remote or even too French. Obviously they're gonna be remote, they're gonna be French. But I also wanted to somehow convey the feeling I had reading them, or reading his letters in general, that he wasn't very remote, that I knew him, that he was present. And let's see, what else? Just my rule was that I didn't add anything fictional, so there's no fiction in here. It's really all his material. The only fiction you could say was once I transported a little tiny thing from Madame Bovary into one of the letters. So at least it was his fiction. And sometimes I would do a little research to supplement something. So there are 10 of them, some a little bit longer, a page or so, and some quite short. The Cook's Lesson. Today I have learned a great lesson. Our cook was my teacher. She is 25 years old and she's French. I discovered that she does not know that Louis-Philippe is no longer King of France and we now have a republic. And yet it has been 5 years since he left the throne. She said the fact that he is no longer king simply does not interest her in the least. Those were her words. And I think of myself as an intelligent man. But compared to her, I'm an imbecile. After you left, you wanted me to tell you everything I did after we left each other. Well, I was very sad. It had been so lovely. When I saw your back disappear into the train compartment, I went up on the bridge to watch your train pass under me. That was all I saw. You were inside it. I looked after it as long as I could, and I listened to it. In the other direction, toward Rouen, the sky was red and striped with broad bands of purple. The sky would be long dark by the time I reached Rouen and you reached Paris. I lit another cigar. For a while, I paced back and forth. Then, because I felt so numb and tired, I went into a cafe across the street and drank a glass of Kirsch. My train came into the station, heading in the opposite direction from yours. In the compartment, I met a man I knew from my school days. We talked for a long time, almost all the way back to Rouen. When I arrived, Louis was there to meet me as we had planned, but my mother hadn't sent the carriage to take us home. We waited for a while, and then by moonlight, we walked across the bridge and through the port. In that part of town, there are two places where we could hire a hackney cab. At the second place, the people live in an old church. It was dark. We knocked and woke the woman, who came to the door in her nightcap. Imagine the scene in the middle of the night with the interior of that old church behind her, her jaws gaping in a yawn, a candle burning, the lace shawl she wore hanging down below her hips. The horse had to be harnessed, of course. The breeching band had broken, and we waited while they mended it with a piece of rope. On the way home, I told Louis about my old school friend, who was his old school friend, too. I told him how you and I had spent our time together. Out the window, the moon was shining on the river. I remembered another journey home late at night by moonlight. I described it to Louis. There was deep snow on the ground. I was in a sleigh wearing my red wool hat and wrapped in my fur cloak. I had lost my boots that day on my way to see an exhibition of savages from Africa. All the windows were open and I was smoking my pipe. The river was dark. The trees were dark. The moon shone on the fields of snow. They looked as smooth as satin. The snow-covered houses looked like little white bears curled up asleep. I imagined that I was in the Russian steppe. I thought I could hear reindeer snorting in the mist. I thought I could see a pack of wolves leaping up at the back of the sleigh. The eyes of the wolves were shining like coals on both sides of the road. When we reached home at last, it was 1 a.m. I wanted to organize my work table before I went to bed. Out my study window, the moon was still shining on the water, on the towpath, and close to the house on the tulip tree by my window. When I was done, Louis went off to his room, and I went off to mine. The visit to the dentist. Last week, I went to the dentist, thinking he was going to pull my tooth. He said it would be better to wait and see if the pain subsided. Well, the pain did not subside. I was in agony and running a fever. So yesterday I went to have it pulled. On my way to see him, I had to cross the old marketplace where they used to execute people not so long ago. I remembered that when I was only 6 or 7 years old, returning home from school one day, I crossed the square after an execution had taken place. The guillotine was there. I saw fresh blood on the paving stones. They were carrying away the basket. Last night, I thought about how I had entered the square on my way to the dentist, dreading what was about to happen to me, and how, in the same way, those people condemned to death also used to enter that square, dreading what was about to happen to them, though it was worse for them. When I fell asleep, I dreamed about the guillotine. The strange thing was that my little niece, who sleeps downstairs, also dreamed about a guillotine, though I hadn't said anything to her about it. I wonder if thoughts are fluid and flow downward from one person to another within the same house. Pouchet's wife. Tomorrow I will be going into Rouen for a funeral. Madame Pouchet, the wife of a doctor, died the day before yesterday in the street. She was on horseback riding with her husband. She had a stroke and she fell from the horse. I've been told I don't have much compassion for other people, but I am very sad. Pouchet is a good man. He doesn't see patients but works in zoology. His wife was a pretty Englishwoman with a pleasant manner. She helped him a good deal in his work. She made drawings for him and read his proofs. They went on trips together. She was a real companion. The poor man is completely deaf and by nature not very cheerful. He loved his wife very much and he will be devastated by loneliness. Louis lives across the street from them. He happened to see the carriage that brought her home and her son lifting her out. There was a handkerchief over her face. Just as she was being carried like that into the house, feet first, an errand boy came up. He was delivering a large bouquet of flowers she had ordered that morning. Oh, Shakespeare. the funeral. I went to Pouchet's wife's funeral yesterday. As I watched poor Pouchet, who stood there bending and swaying with grief like a stalk of grass in the wind, some fellows near me began talking about their orchards. They were comparing the girths of their young fruit trees. Then a man next to me asked me about the Middle East. He wanted to know whether there were any museums in Egypt. He asked me, what is the condition of their public libraries? The priest standing over the hole was speaking French, not Latin, because this was a Protestant service. The gentleman beside me approved and went on to make some slighting remarks about Catholicism. Meanwhile, there was poor Pouchet standing forlornly in front of us. We writers may think we invent too much, but reality is worse every time. The Coachman and the Worm. A former servant of ours, a pathetic fellow, is now the driver of a hackney cab. You'll probably remember how he married the daughter of that porter who was awarded a prestigious prize at the same time that his wife was being sentenced to penal servitude for theft, whereas he, the porter, was actually the thief. In any case, this unfortunate man, Tolle, our former servant, has, or thinks he has, a tapeworm inside him. He talks about it as though it were a living person who communicates with him and tells him what it wants. And when Tolle is talking to you, the word he always refers to this creature inside him. Sometimes Tolle has a sudden urge and attributes it to the tapeworm. He wants it, he says, and right away Tolle obeys. Lately, he wanted to eat some fresh white rolls. Another time, he had to have some white wine, though the next day he was outraged because he wasn't given red. The poor man has by now lowered himself in his own eyes to the same level as the tapeworm. They are equals waging a fierce battle for dominance. He said to my sister-in-law lately, that creature has it in for me. It's a battle of wills, you see. He's forcing me to do what he likes. But I'll have my revenge. Only one of us will be left alive. Well, the man is the one who will be left alive, or rather, not for long, because in order to kill the worm and be rid of it, he recently swallowed a bottle of vitriol and is at this moment dying. I wonder if you can see the true depths of this story. What a strange thing it is, the human brain. Here is another story about our compassion. In a village not far from here, a young man murdered a banker and his wife, then raped the servant girl and drank all the wine in the cellar. He was tried, found guilty, sentenced to death, and executed. Well, there was such interest in seeing this peculiar fellow die on the guillotine that people came from all over the countryside the night before, more than 10,000 of them. There were such crowds that the bakeries ran out of bread. And because the inns were full, people spent the night outside. To see this man die, they slept in the snow. And we shake our heads over the Roman gladiators. Oh, charlatans. The chairs. Louis has been in the church in Mantes looking at the chairs. He has been looking at them very closely. He wants to learn as much as he can about the people from looking at their chairs, he says. He started with the chair of a woman he calls Madame Fricotte. Maybe her name was written on the back of the chair. She must be very stout, he says. The seat of the chair has a deep hollow in it, and the prayer stool has been reinforced in a couple of places. Her husband may be a rich man because the prayer stool is upholstered in red velvet with brass tacks. Or he thinks the woman may be a widow because there is no chair belonging to Monsieur Fricotte, unless he's an atheist. In fact, perhaps Madame Fricotte, if she is a widow, is looking for another husband, since the back of her chair is heavily stained with hair dye. The exhibition. Yesterday, in the deep snow, I went to an exhibition of savages that had come here from Le Havre. They were Kaffirs. The poor Negroes and their manager too looked as if they were dying of hunger. You paid a few pennies to get into the exhibition. It was in a miserable, smoke-filled room up several flights of stairs. It was not well attended. Seven or eight fellows in work clothes sat here and there in the rows of chairs. We waited for some time. Then a sort of wild beast appeared, wearing a tiger skin on his back and uttering harsh cries. A few more followed him into the room. There were four altogether. They got up on a platform and crouched around a stew pot. Hideous and splendid at the same time, they were covered with amulets and tattoos. As thin as skeletons, their skin the color of my well-seasoned old pipe. Their faces were flat, their teeth white, their eyes large, their expressions desperately sad, astonished, and brutalized. The twilight outside the windows and the snow whitening the rooftops across the street cast a gray pall over them. I felt as though I was seeing the first men on earth. Their manager claimed they knew a little English, so after the show was over, I asked them a few questions, but they couldn't answer. I was glad to leave that dismal place and go back out into the snow, though I'd lost my boots somewhere. Later, I heard that after the exhibition, their manager abandoned them. They had been in Rouen nearly 2 months by then, first on the Boulevard Beauvoisin, then in the Grande Rue where I saw them. In the end, they were living in a little hotel in the Rue de la Vicomté. Their only recourse was to take their case to the English consul. I don't know how they made themselves understood, but the consul paid their debts, 400 francs to the hotel, and then put them on a train for Paris. They had an engagement there. It was to be their Paris debut. My school friend. Last Sunday, I went to the Botanical Gardens. There in the Trianon Park is where that strange Englishman Calvert used to live. He grew roses and shipped them to England. He had a collection of rare dahlias. He also had a daughter who used to fool around with an old schoolmate of mine named Barbelay. Because of her, Barbelay killed himself. He was 17. He shot himself with a pistol. I walked across a sandy stretch of ground in the high wind, and I saw Calvert's house where the daughter used to live. Where is she now? They put up a greenhouse near it with palm trees and a lecture hall where gardeners can learn about budding, grafting, pruning, and training, everything they need to know to maintain a fruit tree. Who thinks about Barbelay anymore, so in love with that English girl? Who remembers my passionate friend? And sooner or later, I do intend to go on reading Flaubert's letters. Of course, I stopped abruptly as soon as I didn't have to anymore, as I had a lot of other things waiting, but I'd love to find more. And I also found some that didn't make complete stories, but that were very lovely descriptions. You know, a description of a visit to a humble cottage where an old man is sitting by the fire with his war decorations up on the wall behind him, but I don't quite know what to do with them when they're not, they don't seem complete. These are just some new stories, very short, ending in a trio of little travel pieces. The dog hair. The dog is gone. We miss him. When the doorbell rings, no one barks. When we come home late, no one is waiting for us. We still find his white hairs here and there around the house and on our clothes. We pick them up. We should throw them away, but they are all we have left of him. We don't throw them away. We have a wild hope. If only we collect enough of them, we will be able to put the dog back together again. The last of the Mohicans. We are sitting with our old mother in the nursing home. of course I'm lonesome for you kids, but it's not like being in a strange place where you don't know anyone. She smiles, trying to reassure us. There are plenty of people here from good old romantic Willimantic. She adds, of course, a lot of them can't talk. A lot of them can't see. She pauses, looking at us through her thick-lensed glasses. We know she can't see anything but light and shadow. I'm the last of the Mohicans, as they say. Odon von Horvath. Odon von Horvath was once walking in the Bavarian Alps when he discovered at some distance from the path the skeleton of a man. The man had evidently been a hiker since he was still wearing a knapsack. Von Horvath opened the knapsack, which looked almost as good as new. Inside, he found a sweater and other clothing, a small bag of what had once been food, a diary, and a picture postcard of the Bavarian Alps, ready to send, that read, "Having a wonderful time." Waiting for takeoff. We sit in the airplane so long on the ground waiting to take off that one woman declares she will now write her novel. And another in a neighboring seat says she will be happy to edit it. Food is being sold in the aisle, and the passengers, either hungry from waiting or worried that they will not see food again for some time, are eagerly buying it, even food they would not normally eat. For instance, there are candy bars long enough to use as weapons. The steward who is selling the food says he was once attacked by a passenger, though not with a candy bar. Because the plane had been delayed so long, he said, the passenger threw a drink in his face, damaging one eyeball with a piece of ice. The woman next to me on the airplane. The woman next to me has many fast and easy crossword puzzles to do during the flight from a book called Fast and Easy Crosswords. I have only slow and difficult crosswords, or impossible crosswords. She finishes each puzzle and turns the page as we fly at top speed through the air. I stare at one page and don't finish any. The bad novel. This dull, difficult novel I have brought with me on my trip, I keep trying to read it. I have gone back to it so many times, each time dreading it, and each time finding it no better than the last time, that by now it has become something of an old friend. My old friend, the bad novel. And the next, which is one piece, is something I would call maybe an alternate bio. It started when someone in a printed bio said that I was the author of Sketches for a Life of Wassily Kandinsky. I had written a little tiny chapbook called Sketches for a Life of Wassily, but never of Wassily Kandinsky. And I kind of liked that little addition. So I made a note of it, as I make a note of a lot of things. And then I began just always making note of any mistake that was made about me or my name, or where I lived, or anything about me. But that's kind of changed, evolved a bit, so that now any language that seems to apply to me, that seems to be addressed to me, I also make a note of. So it's written in very short sections. It's called Goodbye Louise, which is the way someone hung up the phone after talking to me for a while. Goodbye Louise, or who I am. My name, Linda, Lyinda, Lyidia, Lyndon, Lyda, Lydia, Lydid, Lydia, Liddy, Lydiac, Lisa, Louise, Olivia, Clydia, Slydia, Vidia, Videa, Lydia Clark, Lydia David, Lydia Davids, Lydia Davidson, Lydia Daves, Lydia Davis, Lynn Davis, Lindy Davis, Lily Davies, Lydia J. Davis, Ms. Lydia J. Davis, Lyd Davis 8353, Mrs. Davis, Mrs. Davies, Mrs. Lydia B. Davis, Mrs. Brooks Davis, Mrs. Lydia Davis, Mr. Davis, Mr. Lydia Davis, Mr. Lydia B. Davis, Monsieur Lydia, Monsieur Davis, Ms. Lydia Dange, Ms. David H. Davis, Professor Lydia Davis, Professor Tom, Ms. Douglas, Mrs. Cote, Mrs. Ciparelli, Sir, Madam, Admin, Kadat Wafa Obuz Zwul Zluk Bernu Wawuk, Heather. Where I was born, Nueva York. When I was born, 6 de octubre 1947. Where I live now, Port Ewan, Port Ellen, Port Avon, Port Owen, Poet Ewan, Fort Ewan, and Long Island. What I am, postal patron, the contractor, U.S. person, payee, artist, bride, a party of one, GST, HST, the woman in seven, half of Georgia's 1 o'clock, then wife, current resident, valued unit holder, unpaid beneficiary, designee, job seeker, another person sitting out there, a follow-up, a listener whose name begins with A through M, a small supplier, the intended, Miss Mercy Muhachi's dearest, a correspondent of Sister Mrs. Joyce Easy, Mrs. Clarissa Ann Turner's beloved. What I have, an existing business relationship with Yakima Wee. What my job is, writer in residence at the University of Chicago. Previous employment, writing of film scripts, writer of film scripts, writer of subtitles for a Turkish sitcom. What I have written, Sketches for a Life of Wassily Kandinsky, Breaking It Down, Almost No Mercy, Samuel Johnson is Indignant, Samuel Johnson is Indigent, The Varieties of Disturbance, Verities of Disturbance, Varieties of Disturbacne, Disturbing Variances, Airlifting Horses, Passing Gas. Plot description of my novel, Break It Down. It looks like an open and shut case when a London warehouse is burglarized and suspicion points at night watchman Jim Thorpe as an accomplice. Work in progress. Interview with Avital Ronell, volume 2 of Proust's In Search of Lost Time. Authors I have translated, Marcel Proust. Work I have translated, Proust's Way of Swan, Proust's Memory of Things Past, Proust's Auf der Suche nach der verlorenen Zeit, a poem by Pablo Casals. Awards I have won, Lannan Litway Pride, Shrinement Retreat Center Skit Finalist. Event to which I've been invited, a small party for insiders. what I've been compared to, a cherry, a geyser, the horse's mouth. What my work has been compared to, a walnut, pine boards. Questions I've been asked. Do you have any smoke alarms in your home, yes or no? What they say I have, a passion for travel, quite an imagination. What they say I have had, a recent postal experience. What they say I could do, take home a free bowling ball, adopt a highway, adopt a rest area, adopt a visibility site, attend a free landlord training session. What I enjoy on the train, seat dedicated service. What I have not used, the honor bar in my hotel room. What they have given me here, not a standard room, but a view room. What I might be in violation for having a dirty sidewalk. What they say counts, my opinion. Friends of mine, Miss Ruthie Copeland, female, engineer Don Shishi, chairman of the tender committee, Edna. Other biographical facts, I am dead. Well, this takes only 2 minutes, so is it okay if I go over my 45 minutes? These are very, very, very short pieces that I wrote while translating very long sentences of Proust. Can't and won't. I was recently denied a writing prize because, they said, I was lazy. What they meant by lazy was that I used too many contractions. For instance, I would not write out in full the words cannot and will not, but instead contracted them to can't and won't. Judgment. Into how small a space the word judgment can be compressed. It must fit inside the brain of a ladybug as she, before my eyes, makes a decision. Sitting with my little friend in the sunshine on the front step, I am reading a book by Blanchot, and she is licking her leg. The language of the telephone company. The trouble you reported recently is now working properly. Housekeeping observation. Under all this dirt, the floor is really very clean. Bloomington. Now that I've been here for a little while, I can say with confidence that I have never been here before. PhD. All these years, I thought I had a PhD, but I do not have a PhD. Thank you. Whatever the time allows.
Well, one question, since we're over time.
I didn't realize I would cut out questions. That's a shame.
There's always the lounge. Will you be mobbed by?
I've got three questions.
You think that's all right? All right. We're going crazy now. All the questions you want.
Three questions.
Are you alive?
I think so, but someday that will be true. So I don't know what becomes of the piece once that's true. We're referring to the last statement in the Bible. I am dead.
I wonder if that
comes naturally to you? Is it just an expression of who you are? Or is that a crack you develop in working?
Maybe reveling in it is developed over time, but I've always been pretty precise. I have to confess I grew up in a family of writers, and my father was an English professor. And we were corrected, not if we spoke grammatically incorrectly, because normally we did speak very correctly, because that's what we heard. But if we didn't speak well, you know, if we made an inadvertent repetition, an ugly repetition, as Flaubert tried to correct himself, that sort of thing would be corrected. So I could not help, you know, it developed an amazing self-consciousness, which of course had its bad side too. But it made me very sensitive to, I'm really not a pedant, I have to say. I really am not an awful schoolworm. I'm willing to be very incorrect, but I like to know when I'm being incorrect. And, yeah, how the translating affects my own work. It's not oppressive. I'm not going to be doing more books, really. Enough is enough. But I continue to enjoy doing the short things. And it's another form of writing, obviously, but without the agony of, you know, is this idea worth pursuing? Is my invention good? Is how shall I structure this? So a lot of the agony is taken away, and you have just the sort of putting the words together and trying to do it the best you can. Like that aspect. And I guess I always learn a lot of new things, either about English or about French. And also, I think what I've also always liked about it is that I enter another world. I mean, for the time that I'm translating Flaubert, I'm very deeply in his world and his time. And I, much as I value our life in these United States now, I really like getting away that way and into a completely different culture. And maybe disappearing from myself for a while, too. Since I'm no longer me at all. I'm just trying to be a conduit for whoever I'm translating. So I highly recommend it.
Thank you, everybody. Please buy books and join us upstairs in the lounge for a reception.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.